My name is Jody Cressman, and this is a forum on Hiroshima Day in 1990. The working title of the forum is What's Worth Going to War About? What's Worth Going to War About? I say it twice because we lost our blackboard, our whiteboard, whatever was up here, the color of the rainbow it was. I think it's appropriate on Hiroshima Day to open a discussion about this topic with a prayer. Let me ask you to join me in a prayer. One of the prayers left in the fireside room here today during the day-long vigil. Dear God, what awful feelings we have today when we remember the pain caused by war, by human sinfulness. How can you still love us? How can you still forgive us? Forgive me. Forgive us now our sins as we forgive those who sin against us. We have to trust your mercy. We have to trust your peace beyond understanding. And we pray that you will enable us to work for a peaceful world. Amen. Well, the question is, what's worth going to war about? And it seems to me a particularly apt time to be asking that question anew, and not necessarily bringing any kind of formulaic answers to it. People of the United States have found a variety of reasons to go to war since the founding of our country. Political independence, abolishing slavery and preserving the Union, expanding into new land, making the world safe for democracy, eradicating Nazism, fighting communism. Different wars at different times have had varying amounts of support among the U.S. people. And I suppose that one of our advantages in this country is that level of support actually matters. That is, something of a sales job has to be done, or a flim-flam job at least, has to be done to bring the American people into war. I want to just start by saying that it's a particularly apt moment to re-ask this question, what's worth going to war about, because of the huge and rapid changes going on in the context of our asking that question. The first is the change that we're thinking about together, meditating on all day today. It's a 45-year-old change, which probably, even today, we haven't adjusted to. The amount of destructive power in the world today is thousands and thousands of times larger than either the bomb dropped on Hiroshima or that dropped on Nagasaki. Einstein said, as you all recall, this bomb has changed everything except our way of thinking. And 45 years later, that's about where we are, seems to me. The sophistication of the weapons systems has grown to the point where only highly trained experts actually understand how they work or the amount of destruction they can wreak. And for a country that prides itself on a democratic heritage, where the people do in fact have something to say about whether or not the nation goes to war, that in itself is a fearful new development. The second of the two major changes contextually that seems to me to set a new stage for the asking of this question is just, you know, simply to say the obvious, the incredible changes of the last couple of years, the sort of geopolitical scope of the world. Everything has changed in terms of East-West relations. So that the kind of argumentation that answered the question almost without thinking for most Americans for the last 40 years, what is worth going to war about? Eradicating communism, I suppose, huh? Wouldn't that be the answer that most people would give to that question? Since at least the late 1940s. All of a sudden, that major answer to that question has exploded. And lots of people who have been building an ever-expanding military economy based on that answer to our question tonight are being asked now to rethink what other kinds of answers to that question are possible in our world. That's the question for us tonight. This is going to be mostly a discussion. I've asked three folks to open up with brief reflections on that question for a new time. And then I invite all of you to provide either further complications to that question, or if you think there are answers, help us think about that too. Ask Joan Pope and Scott Hasserud, Peter Nash, to lead off with a few things. Joan did a session earlier this morning that, among other things, reset our context for us and provided us with lots and lots of peacemaking resources. Joan comes to us from the ELCA headquarters in Chicago with a portfolio of peace and justice work for the women of the ELCA. She spends her life on peacemaking issues. What does the question raise for you, Joan?
Well, first of all, I didn't like the question, so, but I will
revise it.
I came up with three kinds of responses. First of all, that I'm not willing, and I'm hoping the rest of the people in the U.S. aren't willing to tell folks in other countries what they should go to war about, particularly black South Africans, that we in the U.S. should not say to Mandela, you should not go to war to get rid of apartheid. I don't think we should try to impose that on another country. Nor the Palestinians, to tell them that their intifada is unjustified, that they should not go to war with that. I don't like the killing that happens with that, but I don't think that we are in a position to tell other people what they should go to war over. And I think there might be some situations in Central America or the Philippines that, well, we have to withhold our judgment and let the people there decide if they're willing to go to war. The next part I thought about is what I don't think the U.S. should go to war over. I would hope that if the decision in the Philippines doesn't go the way the U.S. wants it, and that the Philippines decides that they don't want our bases anymore in 1991, that wouldn't be a reason to go to war. Or if the situation in Germany changes and all our military bases in Germany are no longer wanted, I would hope that we wouldn't go to war over that. I would hope we wouldn't go to war over our oil supply. Though I think when those kinds of balances shift in the Middle East, that when our oil seems to be going up in price, that many people lean towards going to war. And I would hope that we don't go to war just to protect our affluent way of life. Then I have a category of some maybes. Maybe we should go to war to protect Christianity if that seems endangered. But wouldn't negotiating be a better way to protect Christianity than going to war over Christianity? And maybe we should go to war to protect democracy if a Nazi-like totalitarian government sought to overthrow us. But when I was preparing for the session this morning, I did some reading, and I don't remember who it was, about the neglected part of our history and how much the negotiation that preceded the Revolutionary War has been neglected. That from 1765 to 1775, there was a lot of non-violence ways of objecting to the way the British were treating the colonists. But in the excitement of the battle and the revolution, we've kind of neglected that. And so that maybe even to protect our democracy, we shouldn't go to war. And I just have one additional thought that doesn't really relate to the question, but it seems to me that with the atomic bomb in 1945, that was the point at which technology really exceeded our ability to do our ethical questions. And we've been getting further and further behind ever since. But as our technology zooms ahead, our human reasoning and ethics is still lagging behind and still stuck 1945 and prior.
Okay. So we've got a list of no's, we've got a list of maybes, and we've got some reasons to be skeptical about whether it matters at all what we say. Right. Scott Hasaru talked for a long time about these questions. He serves in congregations and international settings. How do you come at this?
What you can say thought for a long time today about.
Haven't even seen you today. I don't know what you're thinking about these days.
Well, I'd like to raise two issues that might be helpful for us to gather our thoughts around. The first, Joan has already raised for us, and that is that one of the current conflict in the Mideast raises for us the question, will we go to war over our lifestyle? I think that's very clear that that's the issue. Any talk about an invasion of sovereignty, I think, is purely a mask. No one is particularly fond of the Kuwaiti government. Arabs are not fond of the Kuwaiti governments. They are very critical of the sumptuous lifestyle of Sheikh Jaber al-Ahmed al-Sabah. Popular Arab perceptions focus on the tales of sumptuous lifestyles of some Persian Gulf rulers. I'm reading now from Monday's Seattle paper. People believe these mirrors are stooges for the Americans. They feel they eat and dance and enjoy themselves while everyone else is suffering, one West Bank journalist said. The Arab people, through Iraq's actions, are suggesting that these Gulf regimes are in need of revising their irresponsible ways and shoulder their responsibilities. That was a quote from a journalist from Oman, and so forth. It seems very clear to me that if we decided to go to war, that in this particular situation now, that basically we'd be making a decision as a nation to go to war to support a lifestyle that we particularly enjoy. And I think that raises a question for us as Christians. Can we justify going to war to support a particular lifestyle? Is that a legitimate reason for us to go to war? Now, the second issue that I thought would be interesting for us to talk about tonight would be the question, can we afford to go to war? I'd like to suggest that we can no longer afford to go to war, no matter what the circumstances are. That the impact on the destabilization of other countries and what that means economically. And we've seen example after example of that, the ravages of war after even peace has come, supposed peace to those countries. We are only now beginning to understand what a fragile environment we all live in, and the impact of a major conflict on the earth now, with the cost of that, I think would be beyond what any of us would want to bear if we stop to examine the results of that war. I guess just the third thing then is something also that Joan mentioned, and that is that we no longer have the luxury, I believe, of deciding what we're going to do after something happens. I think we've got to make that decision now about whether we're going to go to war. Because of modern technology and the implications of the power that's available in the world to do war, that we as a Christian community need to make a decision about whether we will participate in a war if it's offered up for us by a political leader and others. Will we sign up? And I think we have to make that decision now rather than later. So those are three questions that I'd like to see us talk about tonight. Are we willing to go to war for our lifestyle? Secondly, if we're really honest with ourselves, can we afford a war? And thirdly, can we wait to make a decision about it?
Okay, thank you, Scott. You may be pointing to a need to re-examine some traditions that Lutherans aren't always at home in, Christian pacifist traditions, or I remember John Howard Yoder likes to come up to Holden and tell everybody who's Lutheran up here that if we really did take the just war theory seriously, which is our tradition, that there's no way we could go to war after the atom bomb. It sounds like you're pointing us in the direction of re-examining some of those. Peter Nash. Peter has been teaching for the last number of years at Garrett Evangelical in Evanston, Illinois, and he's been teaching us for the last 10 days a number of themes, including a thorough examination of the Old Testament notion of shalom, God's wholeness, certainly a sort of rich understanding of peace tradition. Peter, how do you come at this?
Well, I come at a lot of ways, and I'm really tempted to just blurt out in response to some things, but I decided that I would inflict upon you this part of this book that I've mentioned to some of you in class. It's Morley Safer's flashbacks. But Morley Safer is not known as some of his colleagues call him Immorley Safer. He spent 3 years reporting from Vietnam for CBS. Most of you know him from 60 Minutes. And President Johnson tried to get him fired, called him a communist dupe. As did the editor-in-chief of Newsweek before Congress. So he doesn't come just with the best of reputations, so I think he must be reliable. Last year he went back to Vietnam and interviewed some old friends, some of whom did turn out to be North Vietnamese spies, and a lot of service men and women. And I'd like to just back up one step. During the Vietnam War, I was in high school, and I said before you, as the Michigan Boys State Patriot Award winner, that the American Legion looked at me and heard what I had to say about the Vietnam War and said, well, he's a real patriot. 20 years later, as I have a son and look at him, one of the first things that came to mind when he was declared healthy was, oh, I hope we don't go to war. And it's odd to be in that position already, to find myself at an age to even think that. But what I'd like to read is the recollection of a soldier who was 19. His name was Van Lê, a North Vietnamese soldier who had marched from north to south to participate in the war. He had volunteered, and after living for weeks in tunnels, he talks about the best day of his life, which is immediately followed by the worst day of his life. The biggest day of my life at age 18 was the day I walked into a village with some civilians and we went to the market and bought tea and ate some sweets. You cannot imagine what it was like to breathe real air and to have the sunshine in your face. The next morning, early in the morning, the artillery started. It was from the guns of the American 25th Division. Then we heard the helicopters coming. They seemed to be coming from every direction. They dropped the troops off in some deserted fields. They came toward the village, but when we started firing, they withdrew. And afterward, the Americans started to shell us with the special colored smoke bombs to mark our position. I was frightened because the smoke was coming very close. When the artillery started again, one of the first shells fell 50 meters away. Two of my comrades in the very next bunker were killed. The Americans started coming again, but they were behind a green fence, and we couldn't see them well. They were protected by the trees, and then they started to spread out. In the bunker, I told one of my soldiers, there were three of us in the bunker, I told him to go out and see what the Americans were going to do, but he refused to go. He was a new drafted soldier, and it was his first battle. And he just lay there on the ground, shaking. I had to go. I was the leader, the 19-year-old leader. When I came out of the bunker, I saw a big American creeping toward our shelter. He was face down in the underbrush, and I think he was trying to get behind a tree. All I could see were his shoulders and his helmet, a green helmet, and I still remember the sight. I remember that it looked like a big beetle coming toward me, coming right at me. He kept coming toward me, and I knew if he saw me, he would kill me. There were only 50 meters between us. I raised my rifle and started to shoot. One, two, three shots. I saw the helmet jump up a little, and then it laid still. The beetle laid still. I was not sure he was dead. I waited until 4 o'clock after all the Americans had left, and then I scrambled toward the tree. And he was there a few meters from the tree. He was dead. I think he died immediately from the first shot. I took his watch, and I took his M16, and I took some pictures he had in his wallet. They were pictures of him and a woman and two small children. He was a black man. And Safer asked, how did you feel? I mean, about killing another man. At the time, I felt nothing. After the peace, I went back to the north, to my home village, and I saw the mothers of friends of mine who had been killed in the war. In the group of 20 boys who joined the army, only 10 of us came back. I saw how much those mothers suffered, and I thought of the American mothers. I think any bullet from whoever it comes is shot first at the mother and not at the son who was killed. When I think of Theo's mother and myself, I find it hard to conceive of anything that is worth going to war for. Every war, my field is ancient Near Eastern history and Hebrew in particular, and Hebrew language in particular. And every war recorded, both sides seem to have just claims. The first recorded war in Sumer was over water rights to make the land fertile for the people. And the great king won the war. But those who fought and died didn't enjoy the water. And I can't see any need for giving up our young men, and in some cases, in some countries, our young women, for the kinds of things that we have traditionally fought for. I was really struck when I read this passage, and I actually started to weep when I got to the passage, he was a black man, because so many African Americans have fought in our wars from the revolution to Vietnam, in order to prove that we are citizens and patriots. And somehow, as a nation, we still don't seem to hear that we are part of the fabric of this country. So I'm not willing to send my son for anything.
Not even your liberty? You give that up? And his liberty?
How would you define my liberty?
Being under communist or some regime like that, where you can't think?
Well, my father fought in Korea and in World War II for our liberty, and he didn't get it. I think the questions that were raised earlier as to what kind of a lifestyle we're going to provide have to be answered before I can say to my son, I mean, this is his choice to make, obviously. But as I sit back and watch what I was fortunately not called to do, but willing to do during the Vietnam War, and now I read about what we were actually doing there and see what kind of difference that it's made for what little difference it has made for African American men and women. It's an absurd price to pay for the return. The liberty that warfare has provided in this country for all of us, but especially for people of color, hasn't really been liberty. It's been over and over again the ability to consume more.
I think it would be different if we were under the Nazis or the Japanese now. That's where we would have been, but if that bomb hastened the end of that.
Yeah. You have a different memory from mine. You lived through World War II. I was born 8 years after it was over, and that does make a difference. My generation saw the lies of Vietnam. You fought a war where the average soldier was a volunteer and 26 years old, and the army had just barely begun to be integrated. My generation, and again I'll say I was not part of that, fought a war where the average soldier was a draftee, 19 and black. Very, very different picture of what fighting for liberation is.
Invite others to join the discussion. Yeah.
Well, it seems to me it's quite interesting. We're trying to decide what it is we would go to war for. Rather than no war at all. We sit and at our best vespers, and it was very touching. And I, my son and I had some discussions after that, but not always in agreement. But we say, because of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that we must now go back and reassess, in essence, what we would go to war for, or should we, or shouldn't we. And it's almost like saying, it's all right to kill with a single bullet or with a sword, a spear, a flamethrower, I mean, we can go on and on. But if it's going to be an atomic weapon, then we've really drawn the line. And I'm not sure I even understand that mentality. The question is, why should we be putting up with this inhumanity to man? The question is, there shouldn't be a war. not within what constraints? How do we stop war altogether? How do we get back to brother and sister of the universe?
Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, I'd like to say two things. One is in response to this point about why is it that after a nuclear bomb we start reassessing. The people I know who are more well-versed in these arguments than I have helped me to understand that kind of response may come out of just what Jody was talking about, which is a just war theory. We can apply certain criteria to an armed conflict and say, does this situation require, not required, is this situation so extreme that by taking an extreme action we will prevent a worse evil from happening? And the extremity of nuclear bombs is such then that some people say we have to treat those differently. That's one way of thinking about the question, but what you're suggesting is another way of thinking about it, which is not just the extremity of it means we have to reassess what is a just war, but maybe that the extremity shocks us so much that we reassess, is there such a thing as a just war? That's one thing. But at the same time, I think listening to someone talk about the phrase peace with justice. And although I'm not sure I agreed with him entirely, I was struck by his assertion that there is never justice and peace at the same time. And that we're deluded if we think we can come to justice in such a way that there is no unpeace in the process. And maybe that's what Joan was driving at, which is that we can't say in South Africa, wait, be patient. I'm not quite sure what to do with that, except that when I think about what would be so extreme that I would resist, the thing that keeps flashing through my mind is Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale. And when I read that with students, the question we kept asking is, what is an authentic human life? So that maybe the question that we're asking is as much about that as it is about war. What are the absolute limits to contracting human life before we resist? And it's frightening to think what that might be. But there are limits that are, I think there may be limits, although when I listen to Peter talk, my heart says, yeah, you're right. But then I just wonder, where would it come that I would resist? Because what you're talking about is protection. I want to protect my own. And where does the point come where protection is becomes aggression rather than resistance of aggression? I don't know where that is. But just to say that I wouldn't ever come to it, I don't think that's true.
Peter, do you have any brief response to that?
Not to that part in particular, but the earlier part when we went back to just war, it's something that you and I just briefly talked about and it came up with Scott's specific example. We are, as a whole, I think, I've never really understood just war theory. There are too many caveats in it for my non-legal mind to and barely theological mind to cope with. But I do understand at least the theory of holy war as it exists in the ancient Near East, and I think in the Middle East today. And we have to be clear when we talk about what we're willing to fight about, that there is a whole group of people in the world, religious people, if you will, if not pre-scientific, the religion really sways how they use the science, who are right now sitting on the border, sitting in Kuwait, sitting on the border of Saudi Arabia, who are willing to die for what they perceive to be a holy cause. Whether or not, no matter how we look at it, they have a command from God to fight. And if they fight in this glorious fight, they're immediately taken out. If they're martyred, they're not casualties, they're martyrs. That puts a whole different slant on it when we know that they are rapidly approaching nuclear capacity. I mean, that's the one thing that Saddam Hussein doesn't have yet, but he's so close. He was so close that the Israelis bombed him in, what, 80? Or 83? But at any rate, he's that close. Gaddafi is close. And who knows who else is really close over there. And the Israelis have a similar, the religious Israelis and some of the not-so-religious Israelis have a similar theology or ethic of, it's better to be blown off the face of the earth than to suffer this oppression.
Others entering the question at any of its sort of 14 angles at this point. Eric?
Well, I'd just like to interject into it that I believe we're a warrior nation. We always have been. And I know in my heart that we're at war now in many places in the globe. It's amazing to me that we're having this discussion the way we are. When you say, will we go to war to protect our lifestyle? We are. We are now, at this moment. And we'll go to the war over the silliest things. We go to war, commit violent, their acts of war to boost up a president's popularity. What we did at Grenada, we went to war there to rescue some medical students, supposedly. And that's the best explanation they could come up with.
Medical students whom we didn't want operating on us to begin with.
Right. I was at my parents' at Christmas time, and I was so, there was such a hopeful feeling in the world, and we were watching these governments change hands with very little violence, and we sent in an army into Panama after some of that. We have all kinds of wars, and thankfully, Jack Nelson Pallmeyer was here explaining to us, about this new style of war, which we see happening all the time. And I think we should recognize this or discuss it. And I think, but at that, I think we should recognize that we do benefit from, the position we hold. The price of our goods, I think, is directly related to the amount of munitions we have. And it's just the same way a lot of people I don't think, really understand what racism is. I'm a racist. I benefit from what my white skin and economic position brings me. I know I do. I benefit that my country is a warrior nation, that we happen to hold, so many weapons.
Maybe Ankur, you want to get into that? The balcony is talking this evening, Rick.
Couple points. One, to get back to what Scott said about the cost of war, and you could think back to the skirmish over the Falkland Islands between Great Britain and Argentina, and to so many of us that seemed like such a silly thing, but what seemed to shock people was the effectiveness of the weapons and the tremendous cost inflicted within a few days, just millions of dollars damage, and the lives lost, and the Argentinian economy nearly shattered as a result. So that's just a taste of what the cost of war might be, just in that sort of thing. And the other point that I would bring up is that before things heated up in the Middle East, the military buildup was focused on drug cartels in South and Central America, and the whole notion of, well, in this new peacetime of now focusing the military might on the drug problem, and you know, that may be a question that we want to talk about, whether drugs or something we're willing to go to war.
A number of themes here that are being raised have to do with the sort of shift in focus from east-west conflicts and tensions to north-south conflicts and tensions, where racial differences, among other things, begin to play into the equation a lot more upfront. Others? Yes?
I spent quite a bit of time over the last 7 years, I guess, trying to convince people that war was obsolete because of modern technology. All war obsolete because all war could potentially, any conflict could potentially lead to ultimate conflict. And I wasn't willing to accept destruction of the planet. And when I finally understood the logic that even conflict between me and my wife could lead eventually to the kind of expansion of conflict that could lead to nuclear or chemical or pick your technology that would destroy everything as we now know it, became more clear to me that period, war was obsolete. So I come here and start hear somebody ask the question, what will we go to war over? I thought we'd gone beyond that to saying, no, there isn't anything worth going to war over given modern technology. But just as you stated the point just now, I started thinking, well, maybe that was all focused on east-west relationships where all the strategic kinds of weapons come into play. And do we have to go through this same discussion again as we begin to come into conflict more directly in the north-south, racial, economic, other kinds of issues? I got to do some more thinking about that, but maybe that is where we now are.
It's interesting to connect your point with Eric's. Eric's bringing back to mind Nelson Palmyre's argument that the Defense Department has already told us that there is another way to wage war, called low-intensity conflict.
Well, which we don't obviously, have to they do have an agenda. They've got a way of life that they have to support.
Sure.
And convince us.
Well, Caspar Weinberger was very clever about that during the Reagan administration when he made that outrageous comment that women in the United States were more concerned about the carrots of their guns than to be bothered with throw weights and all the things that you had to be concerned about when you talked nuclear disarmament. And then you just put it right out there on the table, took it right on the chin for it. But we kept Reagan in office.
Does it change things, this shift, this massive shift in terms of what's happening with East-West relations? Does it change things in our minds, your minds? I noticed when you started that conversation this evening that part of what you referred back to as the key example of what it was that was worth fighting about was communism. I think that's
not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
Our liberty.
Liberty.
They want communism, fine. Our liberty. Yeah, everyone. Mm-hmm. Yours, mine.
Well, Toby, I noticed the way you phrased the question. It's real abstract. It has no person in it. Not what are you willing to go for, to war for. Not what are we willing to, but just what's worth going to war for. And we keep each of us who responds is sort of supplying the person.
Sure.
I think we're being terribly seduced I think Americans, on the whole, bought the nuclear rationale. That's too expensive. And I think with the events in Eastern Europe, that we've been further convinced as a nation that that's outmoded. And so what I think is happening psychically in the collective right now is that we're hustling to find some other ways to keep war alive. And the tremendous danger with the situation in the Middle East, I think right now, is the fact that any advances we might have made over a kind of peace dividend concept, or our ability to discuss that as a nation, have now suddenly been snatched away from us, or are in danger of being snatched away from us again. Because now we're going to be convinced that you read the language in the press, we have another Hitler on our hands. That's the language everybody's is using the same. And one day there's Congress voted out a whole bunch of weapon systems, and then the next day they said Hussein has reawakened us, I think is the words of our Senate or Congressional House leaders. And so a whole bunch of systems
just
were
before the budget summit.
Was that it?
It's resolved. You know, the whole issue about the budget is resolved. It's convenient how this all happens.
So someplace we've got to make a fundamental decision. I think we've got to make a fundamental decision as a nation, and certainly we do as a Christian community, about, you know, where we're going to stand on this issue. We're going to constantly be seduced into, it'll be a drug war here, or it'll be, you know, or low-intensity conflict situations, or it'll be this situation or that.
I'm struck that I forgot your name next to me. You ask about, is it all right
Leo
with a sword or a gun? And that's exactly why I read, in part why I read the piece, because it was the example of one 19-year-old shooting probably another 19-year-old. And the consistent story that Safer brings back in 1989 and 90 from Vietnam was that the Vietnamese, who were fighting for their own liberty as they perceived it, I mean, they perceived our war as a war of aggression, marched halfway, not all the people he interviewed was, nobody won the war. Nobody won the war. We've got fields that are still full of Agent Orange. We lost the best, you know, the best of a generation, the real patriots. And we've said it. It doesn't matter if you drop. I mean, it matters in terms of sheer numbers and speed and maybe efficiency if you drop a nuclear bomb. But if you kill a person, you kill a person, and nobody wins.
But far more people died in World War II by means other than that, those two bombs. But we've almost forgotten about that, and far more serious atrocities went on prior to that. I'm not playing down the bomb. To go on with what Scott was saying, they played games with our minds, you know, as long as I can remember. I grew up, all through my life I've been told to, you hate this group, you hate that group. But wait a minute, I want you now to love this group. And I think we're at a position right now where a little of that's going on now. You know, the budget's been cut back. All of a sudden, this big red threat is gone. It just isn't there any longer. You may want to believe in it, but it's gone. We have to find somebody else to hate and to teach our children to hate so we can keep this big procurement going on. I think that certainly there's got to be better ways than that.
Don't forget the S and L.
Yeah, I don't want
it all happening. All about the right.
And do forget the S and L. Is the point. Do forget.
Always reminds me of something that Dick Gregory once said, you know, about his children. I'm not teaching them anything. You know, like I'm saying, I hope to my children, I don't want you to hate anybody. please don't buy those stories. And I think, boy, there's a big sale job getting ready to go on now.
I think one of the things that the Christian community can do that would make a difference is to put energy into alternative news sources. Because if, when we rely just on the major networks and the major newspapers that are owned by a few corporations, then we aren't getting a really, truly free press. And we have to have informed citizenry in order to be able to make some decisions.
Well, I think that we dropped the bombs because we were afraid the Russians were going to come to the war, and then we have to share the peace process in relation to Japan with the Russians. Because that the same old fear of Russians causes to live. As far as I've read history, there's no reason to drop that bomb. It wasn't a rat. The rationale is that we were losing men, we're going to lose a lot, but everything I've read says they were ready to collapse. It was a question of who was going to participate in the peace process. And it seems to me that the forces in this country that control the country and control our foreign policy are going to get stronger and stronger, and before long we'll go to war all over the world in order to keep markets open, because we're moving toward a world market, and we have a philosophy that there ought to be a world market. We ought to be able to deal and sell and manufacture more or less on our own terms, you know, in any country in the world. And that the military might of the United States will follow the capital of the United States. So that we are likely to do all kinds of things. As far as I can see, there isn't any just war anymore. Low intensity war isn't just. Everybody, civilians, everybody gets killed if you follow the just war theory. So I think that, and so far as conventional weapons, if you look at Dresden, what happened with the bombings without the nuclear weapons, the city was literally wiped out with ordinary. So I don't know why the weapons. I think it's apostasy that we have the weapons, because we have the capacity to destroy the conditions for life. And I don't think that God ever intended anybody to have that capacity. And I think it's anti-God, certainly, to have the capacity to destroy the conditions. Right. But the point I'm trying to make is that the wars are in defense of interests, and the question is whose interests are served by the war, and how are we aware of what the real interests are that are causing us to get the kind of information we do, and to get the kind of rationale for using our forces. And so far as I can make any analysis, and it's all related to the environment too. The forces that are in control of the decision-making process are defending our style of life, our economic interests, and the preservation of our economic affluence. And that's the issue in the Gulf. We spent $28 billion here a while back when we had the scare about the Gulf, and we had all the way up, you know, $28 billion. And that's not a cost that any of us bore, or that the oil industry had to pick up, because the nation did it on behalf of our economic system. That's what it did. So our economic system simply got that subsidy of $28 billion. And if we had energy efficiency, we wouldn't need the Kuwait oil. If we would make rational decisions about the way we use our oil and the way we use our energy, we wouldn't have to. We wouldn't have the trade deficit, and we wouldn't have the pollution or the global warming emissions if we made rational decisions. But it isn't in the interest of the present economic forces in this country for us to make rational decisions.
The $28 million was where?
For the military, for the ships and all that.
As a presence.
Who went over there and defended the company to all of the tankers.
I think we're not blaming everybody else for those rational decisions, but it seems to me at the core there are rational decisions. How energy efficient are we as individuals? What cars do we drive? What appliances do we buy? How do we deal with our own use of the resources? But it seems to me in the end, it's our purchase decisions which drive that economy out there that we're blaming.
To a degree, I think we have blinders when we're concerned about war. And I think of how terrible the Vietnam War, 50,000 men, the prime of our society from this country, died, many injured. But just across the border after that war, over a million people died, maybe 2 million. And where was the media? You say we want information from the media. We didn't hear anything. How much do you know about the war in North, who am I thinking of?
You think of Cambodia?
Laos?
Haile
Selassie.
Ethiopia.
How much information have we had about that? The true basis of that war, and millions died from starvation. They won't allow the product in. I think we need to take maybe a broader viewpoint than the harm that is done to this country, the harm that is done to the world. We are degrading ourselves to the level of war in Africa, war all over the place. The Near East, and it's just, you say we don't have war, we got wars all over the place. And we should be as concerned about those men of God as we are of our men of God.
You know, I'm going to jump back to the Middle East for a minute. It's interesting, U.S. News about 2 months ago ran an article, a big cover story article about Saddam Hussein as the most dangerous man in the world. But nobody said anything about Hussein while he was fighting Iran. And we were giving both sides arms so that no one would win the war. I mean, that incredible buildup of his, we played a part in it. But that was fine when it was when it suited our State Department and our Pentagon's perceived interest.
What was the idea in that?
The idea?
Yeah, selling to both sides.
Both were dangerous to our interests. So for either to become the strongest party in the Gulf area, they had to come to a draw, so that neither really had power.
But and Russia played the same game, you know. They did likewise.
Pardon?
Russia did the same thing.
I don't get to vote in Russia. That's my concern, and we're not. Most of us don't hear about what we're doing. Back to the idea of what kind of information we're getting. We don't get to hear what we're doing until they switch the players. And suddenly, you know, for 8 years we hated Iran because they invaded our embassy and they held our hostages and on. And then suddenly it's Iraq that we hate. Well, these are the bad guys. We were a little bit wrong, and it wasn't so bad really to sell them arms because we got some of our hostages out. But the point that I started with is, and I want to hammer away at, is that Hussein was a bad guy 10 years ago, but we didn't mind it then when it kept the Ayatollah from being the stronger bad guy. And that's a wicked, wicked game that we continue to play.
It seems that war, we are changing our viewpoint of war. Before it was, for lack of a better word, ideological, and now it's become economic. And I think the Bible
has told about this since way back when, and I can see it coming. You know, I see that we are in the end times, as far as I'm concerned. Of course, it's real safe to say that, because Peter said the same thing. So. But, you know, the Bible talks about a world government being created, and it's not a good thing. And we as Christians should be real careful about recognizing something like that. I think those people end up on the wrong side.
I know I should not, but I really want to jump in on the idea of war being ideological. The holy wars recorded in the Hebrew Bible are property wars. I mean, they just, we need property. We need their economic wars. I almost jumped out of my seat. In the order that you talked about the Civil War to end slavery and preserve the Union, it was preserve Union, and the only way we could do it was to free the slaves. And even at that point, our beloved Democratic Party went out and said to the Irish and the Italians, listen, if you vote for the Republicans, these Negroes will come up and take your jobs. I mean, that's, the wars have always been economic. Always, always, always.
I would tend to agree with you. I think it's that's not how they're viewed by the masses, perhaps.
Oh, but we won't be very honest. I mean, that's the reason that we hear these things about Hussein now.
Well,
is because we're not going to protect our oil per se. We're going because he's a bad guy. He's invaded Kuwait. We don't let anybody invade anyone except except for New York.
I'm just stuck. I'm struck with how fast this hour has gone, and we are close to the end of it here. And I've also been struck by the repetition of some themes through the conversation this evening, which may in fact give us an agenda both to talk about with each other over the next couple of days, but also I think to maybe rethink where we are as Christian people in relation to war these days. Lots of folks tonight have talked about the increasingly central position of economic causes in thinking about war, and the way in which that lens on war and peace issues is probably going to replace whatever narrowly defined ideological kinds of reasons we've been given over the last 40 or 50 years. Lots of people have talked about the way in which the globe gets smaller and our interests defined by whatever segments of society are scattered throughout the world and pull us into the possibility of war all over the place. Lots of people have talked about the connections between the necessity to struggle for justice in increasingly unjust situations on the one hand and the call for peace on the other. Lots of people have talked about different forms of war and the way in which the terror of war and the pain of war can be felt at so many different levels of combat and encounter and technology. It could be that as we rethink the whole context of war and peace issues, that there is in fact a new need for the Christian church to stand someplace more clearly than we've ever stood in this country, with a clearer kind of commitment to peacemaking that can be a kind of beacon at a time when confusion seems to reign. At least it's a possible agenda for us as we head into the next century. And I thank you all for sharing all of the windows onto this question and hope the conversation continues. Can we close with another one of the vigil prayers from today? God of peace, you know us and love us. You know the violence that we all do. You made us free to do it. And you still love us. Teach us to know ourselves better and still to love ourselves. Teach us to seek you and your will. Teach us to joyfully work
for your peace in your world. In Jesus Christ we pray. Amen.